This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a real pleasure to take your calls as well. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I think we have faced threats to our First Amendment freedoms, including those of religion and free speech, for a long, long time in this country, but the last year and a half has really amplified put it on steroids. I think we're facing even greater threats now. And unfortunately, the government at all levels, federal, state, and local, seems willing to use this against us. And I think a man who agrees with me is Kirk Cameron. You're going to recognize him because he played Mike Seaver on Growing Pains, but now he's grown into a much bigger role as an evangelist and also the host of a brand new show called Takeaways with Kirk Cameron. Kirk, it's good to have you back on the program. How are you?
I'm doing great, Lars. Thanks so much. Hey, by the way, is it okay if I take my mask off before
yeah.
I talk to you?
I've got my mask off. I don't have any problem with that. Actually, the reintro to that segment of the show is more of a joke. It's a little inside joke. But I want everybody to be able to make up their own minds.
I appreciated it.
Well, what do you think of the threats that we're up against right now? We've got Navy SEALs who are being told they're going to be drummed out of the service with a dishonorable discharge, and here it is Veterans mm-hmm. Day, because they won't take the jab, and they say, I've got a religious exemption. And the government, in a lot of areas, federal, state, and local, is saying, we don't care, doesn't matter, you don't really have those freedoms anymore.
Yeah, boy, we could talk about this for an hour or two or ten. What I think about it, it's a dire threat. If we lose the First Amendment, if we lose the Second Amendment, these things are absolutely critical. We look at Australia, and you see the videos that your friends are sending you on your phone from Australia, or you look at what's going on in China and other places. This is where the human heart leads when power goes unchecked. That's why our founders were so brilliant in dividing up the branches of government and having a system of checks and balances and making sure that people were able to speak freely and not be muzzled. Because if you can't speak, you can't communicate, and you can't organize, and you can't hang together, and you end up all hanging separately when the government finally gets its way and it's void of biblical principles. So this is super important. And that's why I appreciate you, and I appreciate those who are willing to be the same person in public as they are in private, not camouflaging themselves and becoming chameleons based on the audience they're speaking to.
No, and I try not. In fact, I'm talking to a Veterans Day group tonight, and I'm going to give them the same thing face-to-face that I would give them when I'm doing this. But what makes – I think this puts citizens in a really tough spot because – Kirk, I don't know about you, but I'm generally a law and order guy. I want people to follow the rules. Now, that doesn't mean mm-hmm. that on occasion I haven't smoked a Cuban cigar. I don't regularly. That I haven't gone 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. I mean, things like that. But for the most part, I want us to follow the rules. And I think this is kind of putting people in a position where the government is telling your employer, fire this person, man or woman, if they won't take the jab. And the person is saying, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed mm-hmm. to simply tell the government, no, I'm not going to do it? And I'm hoping some employers do exactly that. And they see the fraud that is, you know, the OSHA ETS rule and all the rest of this, that they'll do that. The problem is we're in a country full of people who, for the most part, do follow the rules most of the time.
Yeah. Well, again, this is a nuanced conversation. And of course, we as people of faith, understand that we're not to be lawless rioters. We're not to be vigilantes. We want to obey the authorities that have been put in place. However, a right understanding of civil authorities, according to Scripture, involves those civil authorities being ministers of God to serve the people, to protect and to make good things flourish and to punish the evildoer. And when the civil magistrates end up violating those fundamental principles by calling good evil and evil good, it's actually the duty of the citizens, according to our founding fathers, our forefathers, and those who came before all of them. It's illustrated beautifully in a book called Lex Rex by Samuel Rutherford. it's the duty of lesser magistrates and the people, who is actually the sovereign of this country, we the people, to replace these corrupt government leaders with people of integrity and people who fear God and love their neighbors. How do we do that now? Well, it's difficult because we've let things deteriorate so far, and people generally are not educated about these things, that we've just been reduced to the narrative of, if you're a good person, do the right thing, which means anything the CDC tells you.
Yeah, and I don't buy that because, I mean, Kirk, look, I'm all for render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. And, I mean, I believe that there are, you know, governments were set up among groups of people. And generally, the Bible is in favor of obeying civil authority. You know, God's sure. laws are something different, but civil authority, you should have respect for that. There's a point to that. I read the book a lot. My wife and I do. But this really puts us in a tough spot as citizens, because I keep getting the ongoing question from people, at what point do we decide that the founders of the country fought off a tyrannical government for its excesses, right. and they warned us that you may face this again? Lincoln himself, 150 right. years ago, said, hey, we're not going to face a danger from Europe or Asia. If the danger comes, it'll be coming from here, right within our borders. Right. And I think a lot of us sense that is happening right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. Our internal alarm systems are going off. I think freedom is something that's so rare and so precious that our founders understood that you needed to be vigilant and you needed to be educated. There's no such thing as a free nation that is not an educated nation. And when we started giving over our children to government school systems that essentially erase the real history of our country, and we begin teaching them things like critical race theory, and we begin teaching them to disbelieve God, disbelieve his word, and believe that, you know, you're inherently racist because of the color of your skin and other nonsensical kinds of things, we're really in trouble. And so I think that speaking the truth, speaking it in love, and having the courage to defend those truths are absolutely critical at this time. And the good news is, we've been able to be apathetic and complacent because freedom has been normal. It's been sort of de facto to most of us who grew up in the 80s and the 90s. But now we're realizing that freedom really is not free. And these are the times that will try men's souls, and heroes will rise out of this kind of an era. And I'm excited about that because it's time for men to act like men, and mothers and fathers to really take their responsibility seriously.
Kirk, thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks so much, Lars.
Pleasure to have you on. That's Kirk Cameron. Glad to be with you and always glad to get your phone calls and emails. It's 866-HEY-LARS, the number to call. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails, and we'll get back to those a little bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And, of course, if you want to take part in the show other ways, you can vote in our Twitter poll. You find that at Lars Larson Show. And if you don't like Twitter, like so many people don't like Twitter, including me, you can go to my website at LarsLarson.com. Everything there is free. Downloads, podcasts, streaming, the whole nine yards. The only thing that costs money is the challenge coins, and that's not going to me. It's going to a veterans group, and we're glad to promote that as well. You know, we talk about mental illness on this show a lot because it ties into so many other problems that American society has, including but not limited to a lot of people living on the streets who were told by the mainstream media, well, most of these people have mental problems. And I've seen other analysis that says, well, many of them have drug problems, but the drug problems either created the mental illness problems or they accentuate mental illness problems that were there already. So I thought we'd talk to a guy who actually knows this, Dr. Ben Miller, who's Chief Strategy Officer for Wellbeing Trust. Dr. Miller, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars, and thanks for covering such an important topic.
Well, so tell me this. Anything I just said that I got wrong, you corrected for me because I want my audience to hear both sides, even if you disagree with me. In fact, my producers would tell you that the reason I say naysayers go to the head of the line is that we've always had that tradition for 25 years. Somebody somebody disagrees with me on a subject, I'm glad to hear their side of it, as long as they'll stick around for a few questions from me.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, let's have a spirited discussion here today, because I think this is where the nation is. And so you raised a lot of issues there. And I want to start by just highlighting that there is no simple answer to get to the questions that you were raising. And so let's just kind of go ahead and agree on that one. But let's break it down a bit for folks. Our nation has been experiencing increasing issues of prevalence around mental illness for some time now. And if you look at us compared to other parts of the world, you'll find that there actually is more mental illness in the United States. When you begin to unpack that, the reasons why are multifaceted, and they usually have to do with social, economic, and other health-related factors. So we can't just say, well, it's this one thing. We actually need to be kind of more broadly inclusive of what goes into mental illness. And that brings us to kind of, well, what do we do about it, right? I think that's probably one of the questions that most people are going to want to know. So if you're seeing someone who's unhoused on the street and they're talking to themselves, most people think and equate that to mental illness. And sure, that person might actually have a mental illness. But the problem with that is that we ignore to our detriment mental health in our own lives. So we actually don't want to be stereotyped as the person who's, you know, talking to themselves on the street. So we ignore addressing depression, anxiety, drinking too much, the drugs in our own life. And that's how we get to a place in society that we have no answers for anyone. And I'd love to kind of walk you through that and talk a little bit more about this.
Well, let's do that, because correct me if I'm wrong, and I think this ties into what you were just saying. One of the things you've helped people do is, for instance, somebody who's got breast cancer, and then they get the diagnosis. And if there's anything that could be depressing, it would be any diagnosis of cancer. So you help people through that. But when you deal with the medical problem of breast cancer, the earlier you get to it, the more likely you are to have a satisfactory solution. And the same applies to mental illness. So I take your point that if people are feeling depressed, especially after, you know, a long time in pandemic lockdown and all the other consequences, you say you ought to deal with that. Except, I mean, a lot of us, I speaking for myself, I say if I'm feeling a little down today, I just say I can handle that. That kind of optimism is a good thing, I would think, from a mental health standpoint. But then saying I'm going to ignore the problem because I know I can handle it on my own, that works against the idea of going out and trying to get some help for it, right? Because most of us think, I don't need help for this. I can get through it.
Well, that's right. And if you actually look at the data, most people who actually do need help don't get help. And so if you just look at mental illness more broadly, about half of folks that have a diagnosable mental illness receive care or don't receive care, depending on how you slice it. And you look at substance use disorders, which are extremely prevalent in the States, only about 1 in 9 folks with an identified substance use disorder is able to get care. And that brings us full circle here to this, what is the reticence that we have as a society to actually seek care? As you were just pointing out so eloquently, like some people might just say, hey, listen, I'm tough. I can get through this. But the problem with mental health is it doesn't always just work that way. It doesn't always just benefit because you want to wake up one day and say, you know what, I'm going to fight through this. Sometimes you actually might need supports that go beyond what you're able to give yourself. And that's where friends and family sometimes come in. That's where clinical services come in. But for me, and I guess for the listeners that are paying attention here today, that this is to me where if I were going to do one thing that could change the culture of how mental health, it's to let people know, first and foremost, that it's okay to not be okay. Like, let's go ahead and normalize that as you just did with cancer. But second of all, that there is help available for those who actually want it, that there are treatments that can make you feel better. There are supports that can allow you access to people who can help you learn new skills or have new tools that allow you to address things in life a little bit differently. But our society, unfortunately, for whatever reason, Lars, we just continue to avoid being able to get that care, or in some cases, we can't get that care. And that could be because of health insurance affordability. It could be because of the fragmented nature of just health care in general.
Although an awful lot of medical care plans that include both those provided by the government, Medicaid and Medicare, and employer-provided health care, and employer policies like, what are they called, EOPs, EAPs, Employee Assistance Programs. Doc, I've got a confession for you. Now, I've told my audience before, but it's been a lot of years, but about 40 years ago, I was working at a job I was happy at. I was having a few problems, you know, that they were dealing with more just practical things. I bought a house that did, and the deal wasn't going the way it should have been. And I was waking up, my stomach was kind of tied up in knots, and I wasn't sleeping as well, and I'd always slept well. I actually went and got a few counseling sessions. Very nice young lady, you know, told me some practical strategies. And after about half a dozen of those, she goes, "You're done." I mean, she didn't cut me off, but she said, "You know, you sound like you're handling it." And I did. So I'm not afraid of that kind of idea. The problem is we have to also give people choice. I mean, you know, for some people in politics, I have to say choice only means killing unborn babies. And I hope that doesn't offend you, Doc, but that's my point of view.
About a year ago, right before the pandemic, a little over a year ago, I was walking with my family. We were going out on a Thursday night with friends. And we were walking down the street coming back from the restaurant, and my wife was ahead of me with our kids, and she noticed this gentleman who was standing on his feet, you know, a bit unsure, unsteady of himself, and he just face-planted right onto the concrete.
Wow.
My kids didn't know what to do. They were looking at me. You know, I, being a clinician, but also someone who's wanting to protect my family, I wasn't quite sure what was going on. So I made them run ahead, and they went on home, and I actually helped the guy up, and I sat there with him. You know, his breath reeked of whiskey. He had been on a bender. He'd been drinking way too much. And I just set him down on the curb, and I looked at him, and I said, "Hey, my name is Ben. What's your name?" And he told me. And I said, "What's going on?" And he just looked at me like, of all the things you could ask me, you asked me the question that I probably can't answer easily. But what he did was he told me about how his wife had died from cancer. His son had moved to South Carolina. That he was alone for the first time in his adult life, that he didn't know where to turn. Did this man have a mental illness? No. Did this man need help? Yes. Was this man willing to seek help? No. He was willing to take it into his own hands, pick up the bottle of booze, and drown his sorrows in the alcohol. That's right.
Yep. That's a very fair point. I'm talking to Dr. Benjamin Miller. He's the chief strategy officer. Good position to be in because he can figure out where the roadmap, where the organization is going for the well-being trust. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll get to your phone calls and emails a bit later. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I thought we'd have an extended discussion with Dr. Benjamin Miller. He's Chief Strategy Officer at Wellbeing Trust. Now, Doc, I want to get back to the people that are probably the most visible evidence of mental illness in our society. As you said, an awful lot of people have problems. Many times they camouflage them very well. Sometimes they handle them fine on their own. Sometimes they just are sick, and at some point they go over the edge, and they may do terrible things like take their own life or take other people's lives or end up on the streets. You gave me the story of the man you met. You and your family had encountered this man. You sat down to talk to him, and he'd lost his wife to death. He'd lost his son to a move. And what I noticed there was he didn't have another network of family of friends. And I just kind of wonder when somebody, I mean, you can have as many friends as you want. You can have as few friends as you want. But I find that an awful lot of the people who are living on the streets, when I've talked to them as a reporter before, they have run themselves out of friends, out of family, and usually out of jobs and support by their own actions. And those are all choices. But if you decide to make those choices, there has to be a consequence of some kind that when you then turn around and say, now I need help because I threw away all the resources that were offered to me or that would have been there for any other person in society, and I decided to ditch them. And usually, I'm going to say this, Doc, for selfish reasons. I like to drink. I like to take drugs. I like to behave this way. Well, I can almost guarantee you that unless you have a circle of friends who like that kind of behavior, most people are going to disown you. But they're going to disown you for tangible and reasonable reasons, right? I mean, I've actually told Doc, I've told friends of mine, they'd come over to my house for a get-together, a barbecue, and they would drink too much. And I'd say, you know what? If that's going to be the way you behave, I'd just tell them, I can't have you in my house. And I did that, and actually some friends said, okay, I understand that. I won't do that anymore. I'm not controlling their behavior. I'm just saying if you want to come to my house, that behavior isn't allowed. I don't mind a drink now and then myself, but I don't want people to drink themselves into a stupor and then perhaps get on the road, go home, hurt people, things like that. So I set a set of rules and consequences, and I've done the same for myself because I'm the son of an alcoholic, a long-term alcoholic who's gone now, but I didn't admire that behavior. It didn't drive me away from an occasional drink now and then, so I'm not a teetotaler, but it did say I'm not going to end up like that.
Well, there's a lot there that we can impact. unpack. Let me first of all just, I think it's really important that you did what you did around setting boundaries. There's boundaries, they provide a certain type of protective role within relationships. Setting boundaries means that this is mine, this is yours, and for us to respect the confines of our relationship, however you define that, that these boundaries are there for good reason. And so you saying, listen, I don't feel comfortable you having too much to drink in my house, that's a boundary that your friend, your colleague, your whomever should respect. But there's a larger issue here, which I think you were touching on, which is around the importance of relationships and how we are inherently social creatures. And if anything, this pandemic has highlighted the fact that we do need each other. We need to be face-to-face. We need to be able to go out and do things together, because in doing so, there is a healing, almost therapeutic aspect of being connected. And a good example of this is that you were talking about the folks that might be on the street or folks that might have gone down and done certain things that have driven other people away.
Yep.
That sometimes in those opportunities or when those things happen, that it actually does sometimes remind us of the importance of how connected we actually are, but how sometimes people will make decisions that push us away. And to recognize that requires us to almost like remove ourselves from the situation and find out if the person is acting in the best interest for themselves or for their family. And sometimes being a friend means that you have to tell someone, hey, listen, I'm not comfortable with what you're doing. Sometimes being a friend means that you need to be there more often and actually holding their hand when they're doing the thing that they're not supposed to be doing, because that's what we need to do as kind of individuals to take care of each other. So I think that like COVID has given us, and I mean, here you and I are talking about this right now, it's given us a unique moment to reflect on what mental health is, the power of mental health within our relationships. And actually, I can't think of another time in my life, Lars, and I've been doing this a while, where we've been so openly discussing issues of mental health as we are now. Now, as we started off the top of the call with, you know, we oftentimes can look at those examples of mental illness or the extreme examples, but rarely are we in a situation where we can just say, you know what, mental health is something that I've experienced during this lockdown. I've actually felt a little sad or anxious. And then to talk about that with other people, it reinforces that social connection, which I actually find to be probably one of the most beneficial silver linings of this pandemic, is that I think we've been made to confront how important each other are, how important we are to each other.
Doc, I want to ask you about something. I want to get to the issue of the people on the streets. There was a great documentary, I don't know if you've seen it, it was done by a guy named Eric Johnson, who's a great reporter out of Seattle, Washington. It's called Seattle is Dying. And he makes the case that we have problems with people on the streets, that the majority of them, by their own account, are there because of addiction problems, substance problems, either alcohol or drugs, illegal drugs. And he got that from the people living on the street, saying everybody they'd encounter has some kind of drug issue that then either creates or contributes to their mental condition. And he pointed out some communities like Providence, Rhode Island, that have actually successfully addressed this, but they do it through consequences. And it seems to me that an awful lot of American society has now decided we don't want to give consequences to people who are living on the streets. We don't want to hold them to the same rules that all of the rest of us have to obey. And we won't use those tools to try to, if you will, force them to amend their behavior. Now, if somebody wants to work a job, pay their bills, pay their taxes, take care of their family, do right, and go home and get busted drunk every single night, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think it's healthy, but it's their business. But the minute they become a problem for the rest of society, society has to be able to say, you have to change your behavior. And we will use every tool in the toolkit that governments have to be able to fix that. Give me your take on that.
Well, let's start with some data around folks that are on the street and mental health, mental illness. I mean, one of the largest studies that was done was just a few years ago, and it found that about a third of individuals that were unhoused or homeless on any given night had some type of mental illness. Substance use is often comorbid or coexisting with mental illness, and so there's a high prevalence of individuals that have some unmet addiction need that are on the street.
Right.
Now, let's talk about what you were saying here on your take on this. And I actually think this is a really important and difficult conversation, because sometimes people who end up without a house and lived up unhoused on the street they have not been able to have the same abilities to get access to help as others. And I don't want to put, I don't want to overgeneralize here. Every case is unique. I want to be careful with how I say this. But I mean, I've done a lot of work on the streets, and I'm sure you have too, talking to folks. And rarely will you find someone who says, this is where I actually always wanted to be. You know, most of the time what you find is that people are terrified around security. They don't feel safe, especially if you talk to women or people in the LGBTQ community. They don't feel safe being on the streets. If you're suffering from an addiction and you're on the street, you're always worried about, am I going to get a dirty needle? Am I going to be able, am I going to overdose? Am I not going to be able to get that drug that I need to, that I feel that I need to stay alive? And so first and foremost, I think we have to acknowledge that there are some major issues in our country that make it more difficult for some people over others to be able to get the things that they need to be successful, whether that's a house, a job, or otherwise. I'd like to think that we were kind of an equal opportunity culture and that everybody could just kind of, you know, pull themselves up by the bootstraps and get going. But I fundamentally have been out there, you know, on the streets too many times and seen that some people need more help than others.
Well,
please go ahead.
I just need to take a break right now, and we'll continue this discussion in the next segment, because I like the fact that Dr. Benjamin Miller from Wellbeing Trust is willing to take some tough questions, and I'm going to see if I can challenge him a bit in the next segment. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails later. Dr. Ben Miller is with me now, Chief Strategy Officer at Wellbeing Trust. We've been talking about people on the streets. We've been talking about addiction. We've been talking about mental health care. Doctor, I want to know, is it unreasonable for society to say that when people begin to behave in an overtly antisocial way, and you know, sometimes I used to be a reporter for both television and radio. Now I'm an opinion guy, but I still consider myself a journalist. But they always want to tell you the story of the person who's on the streets because they hit a major medical problem, or a family member died, husband or wife died, and they were left, you know, without means to continue. Those are always the sympathetic stories. I'm guessing that, like you said, the people who are living on the streets are afraid of many things, afraid of dirty needles, afraid of physical assault, and all the rest. But when they began to take those drugs that, you know, if a third of the people are mentally ill, and some of that is mental illness along with drug addiction, either caused by or contributing to, and the rest are addicts for the most part, that's not the story that most major media tell to the public. They say, oh, there's this poor story about Ben Miller, and he was a really responsible person. He's a PhD or PsyD, and then things fell apart, and he just ended up on the street, and they kind of shorthanded. And you say, wow, that's terrible that an accomplished guy like Ben Miller would end up on the streets. I don't think that's the typical story. My thinking is the typical story is somebody who had a fun time drinking or shooting heroin or smoking methamphetamine or crack, and it was a lot of fun until their job ran out and their family said, to heck with you, and their money ran out, and then they decided to engage, not decided, they were compelled by the chemical to engage in pathological behavior. And you're the guy who's got the PsyD. Tell me this. Is it pathological if I wake up every morning drug sick and my one focus for the next few hours is finding that next fix? I may not want to be there. If you said, do you really want to be here on the streets taking drugs? No, I don't. But boy, do I want that drug fix every single day. And that's pathological behavior, which leads them into other pathologies like robbery, assault, using the street as your toilet in a major American city, to where some cities are starting to look like third world countries right now. That's pathological behavior, and it's antisocial behavior. What should society do to stop that and help the person at the same time?
Well, at the heart of this question, Lars, I think is a need to very clearly define what addiction is. And let's do that just for a second, because I actually think it'd be really helpful for the listeners, and then we can unpack your question a bit more.
Sure.
I mean, addiction is it's a treatable chronic medical disease that involves a multitude of complex interactions. Some of them have to do with your brain. Some of it has to do with your genetics, kind of your physiology. Some of it has to do with your environment, where you live, your relationships. And all of that is wrapped around your individual life experience. So people with addiction, they oftentimes use substances or engage in certain risky behaviors that become, as you were saying, compulsive. And they continue despite the fact that there are harmful consequences, driving friends away, losing your job, losing your home. And that is, in essence, what addiction is. Now, the treatment of that is actually taking into account everything I just said about the definition, requires us to approach it multifaceted. So if you're on the street, the evidence would suggest the most important thing that we can do to begin to help you with your addiction is to find you a home, to get you off the street so that you can actually have the safe, secure, you know, shelter over your head. That's what we would call a housing-first approach. And there's a ton of evidence that suggests that when you can give someone, again, a safe place to live, it makes it a lot easier for them to be able to enter into recovery, where they can find treatment, they can get access to someone that might be able to help them with counseling or some type of medication that assists them with their addiction. But addiction as a whole is, you know, you described it at the beginning as a fun time. I think for some people, there are some fun time aspects to addiction, for sure. There's a reinforcement on the social level. But when you get further into it and it begins to disrupt your life, disrupt your family, your friends, I don't know a lot of people that I've ever seen or worked with in addiction describing it as a fun time. It becomes almost like what you need to have to live and stay alive.
I get that. But, Doc, let me make a distinction. The fun time does not apply to addiction. The fun time applies to taking drugs. And so let's make that distinction. I'm not saying that when you become addicted and compulsively behaving, that you're saying, boy, this is fun to wake up drug sick every morning or every other morning. What I'm saying is when you took that first needle in the arm with heroin or you smoked meth or crack cocaine, I've never done any of those things. The closest I've come was a pre-op shot or a pre-op pill I took once in the hospital. And I said, what is this? And they said, 3 grains of morphine. I was like 16 or 17 years old, and I had to have my foot operated on. And boy, as they wheeled me down the hall, I thought, this is why people have so much fun on this, because you just feel like you're on top of the world, you're flying. And that was the impression I got. That was the impression I got at age 16 of, yeah, I can see how this would be a lot of fun until you're addicted. At the point where you're addicted, I'm not saying that's fun. But taking the drugs before you become addicted, before you engage in compulsive behavior, has to be one heck of a lot of fun.
I understand. Thanks for the clarification. And I do think that some folks probably, especially early on in life, if they're experiencing a drug or alcohol even to an extent, which is just as bad for you, by the way, as many other drugs, but we've normalized alcohol and we have in some other aspects of drugs. You know, maybe it does start with that and it's reinforced by, hey, I was with my friends hanging out and this happened. And so there's always those social reinforcing aspects of this. But to clearly go to the place of addiction, which is where a lot of folks are who are on the street who have that profound need, is where I was trying to point out and just kind of delineate.
Fair enough.
I appreciate the point, and thanks for the clarification.
Dr. Ben Miller, a clinical psychologist and health policy expert. I appreciate him coming on the show. Dr. Miller, thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment. Emails go to talk@LarsLarsen.com.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larsen Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larsen Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and your emails a bit later. You can always vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larsen Show. And if you can't stand Twitter, vote in on the website at LarsLarsen.com. I hear Mark Mills laughing in the background. Mark Mills, and boy, this guy wears all kinds of hats. Senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, which I've always found to be very instructive to read everything that comes out of Manhattan Institute. Faculty fellow at Northwestern University's McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science and co-director of the Institute on Manufacturing Science and Innovation and a strategic partner with Cottonwood Venture Partners. So he's got the education, he's got a foot in academe, he's got a foot in actually applying science to stuff that actually helps us, and then he's got a hand in or a wallet in or a checkbook in actually making these things happen with the money. You've got it all covered, except do you show up on the factory floor and run a CNC machine or anything like that?
Well, you know, back in my impetuous youth, I actually did was a machinist and learned to weld. And I was a motorcycle mechanic. I raced Grand Prix as a foolish youth on motorcycles. So I've tried everything. This is a great version of tried a little bit of everything, not very good at anything.
Well, I'll have to make it clear. There is a famous Lars Larsen who uses two S's in his last name, who is a motocross racer. I think he's still actually doing it in his 80s, but I am not that guy, although I learned his name when I was 11. I was working on my bike when I had a dirt bike, and I walked into the motorcycle shop, and they you know, back in those days, they had to write out the receipt, and they said, what's your name? And I said, Lars Larsen. And they looked at me and said, you are not Lars Larsen. I had no idea what they were talking about, but I later learned that I had a doppelganger who who shared my name, but was much better at riding a dirt bike than I was. I want to talk to you about the science of the Green New Deal and the science of any of the proposals to replace the energy that we depend on with some kind of green alternatives, because you've written some great pieces recently that talk about the fact that as much as people may love the idea, and I know that their heart is where it should be, that's where the liberals go with this, their heart says we should all be able to get by on solar and wind, the math and the science doesn't work. So now that I've given all of your CV and people know how qualified you are, does the science of the Green New Deal actually work, Mark?
Well, it doesn't work the way they think it works. It works in ways that they probably, if they thought about it, wouldn't be happy about. So it's, you know, people think that there's some magic unobtainium. I've used this line before, as you probably know, that exists when it comes to energy, that, you know, electric car, everyone has pointed out the obvious, you have to plug it in. Well, that's the least relevant thing about electric cars. You have to make the batteries with something. And we'll start with the batteries and the science of energy systems. There's no, to use the old physics adage, there's no free lunch, right? And by that, I mean, energy, in fact, itself is free. We had nothing to do with the energy resources in the world, oil, gas, coal, the sun, wind. We didn't create them. We had nothing to do with them. They're just there. The energy that we use to operate our society all comes from building machines that convert a natural free resource into something useful. So everything about the physics of energy is anchored into the machines you have to build, which all wear out, because all machines wear out, which means none of them are renewable. Everything wears out. Everything has to be replaced. And it's how much stuff do you have to dig out of the earth to build those machines? That's what matters. So factoid we could start with. The battery in a typical electric car, which most people don't realize, weighs about 1,000 pounds. 1,000 pounds. That's your fuel tank. Pretty big battery. That's why you have to use aluminum and fiber composites to lightweight the rest of the car to make room for the 1,000 pounds of battery. But it requires something on the order of 500,000 pounds of earth materials to be dug up to build just one battery.
And by the way, the machines that do that have to be built from materials that we mine, and they have to have fuel. And I would imagine at this point, nobody is doing mining. I know that some mining machines run on electricity, some of the bigger earth-moving, you know, stationary things. But when you're talking about taking 50 trucks that will carry 50 ton of ore out of a mine, they don't have an electric version of that yet, right?
Well, the electric versions exist. In principle, they don't work very well because batteries are not very good for long range and heavy lift. So you're right. 99%+ of the energy used to dig up stuff from the earth are oil-fired giant machines made by famous companies like Caterpillar and John Deere and Komatsu, different. So here's a factoid for you. The point when you got out of that one issue, what most people don't realize, the quantity of oil that the global mining industry uses today rivals the quantity of oil that the global aviation industry used before we shut the world down. It's an extraordinary amount of oil used to dig that stuff up. And the Green New Deal path, no matter what form it takes, whether it's the Biden-Harris form, the AOC form, Germany's form, it makes no difference. That path will lead to an increase in global mining, the biggest in the history of the world.
And by the way, Mark, can you reflect on, I've shared this with my audience before, because I'm taking this from a much more simple level than you are. I want to talk about the batteries. But when it comes to, they say, we'll just have everybody buy electric cars. And I looked up the number. Last year, a little less than 250,000 electric cars sold in America. And they said, that's a lot. I said, no, Americans bought 15, 16 million gasoline and diesel-powered cars. So if we could quadruple the number of electric cars sold next year, 2021, it would take 250 years at a million a year to replace. If you did it at the current rate, it would take a millennia to replace. And they say, oh, no, we'll ramp up to 6 or 8 million. I said, oh, well, then it'll only take 40 years to, if we force people to buy those vehicles. The math doesn't work there on the commercial end of things either, does it?
Well, you've just committed a major sin. You've actually done arithmetic. So it's I mean, you know, we talk about illiteracy. There's also innumeracy. You obviously don't suffer from the latter, but well, you're absolutely right. So the scale issue is what matters. Let me do your numbers differently.
All right.
There are about 1 million electric cars in the United States now. There's a surprising number of them, and you're right. So that sounds like a lot until you look at the fact there's 250 million registered vehicles in America.
Yep.
So they account for 0.5% of the vehicles in America at the moment. The world has 5 million electric vehicles, which is a lot more than there were 10 years ago. So it's really quite something. I think this is all due to Elon Musk, by the way. It's due to two people, the inventor of the lithium chemistry back in the late 70s, which was, by the way, an Exxon researcher. Sort of ironic, the invention of lithium chemistry and Elon Musk. You know, Elon Musk did an amazing job of promotion, both in getting credits and, of course, of building cars and a brand. And he's caused the whole world to decide they can have electric cars. But here is, to use a popular phrase these days, if we get to 500 million electric cars in the world, a 100-fold increase in 20 years.
I'm talking to Mark Mills. You'll find his work at the Manhattan Institute. He's also at Northwestern University and with Cottonwood Venture Partners. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this great conversation. Yeah. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a real pleasure to have Mark Mills with me from Northwestern University, from the Manhattan Institute. He's a venture partner, a venture capital guy who actually takes the science he knows and then applies it to actually turn into things we need. He co-founded Digital Power Capital, which was a venture capital firm, and was chairman of CTO ICX Technologies. We've been talking about the sort of the impracticalities of the Green New Deal, and we started out with vehicles. Before we leave vehicles altogether, can you speak to this? I love following a Twitter account called Babylon Bee, which is a Christian based, but they do parodies.
Correct.
And they have Gavin Newsom in one recently where it says, "Governor of state with no electricity suggests everybody drive an electric car." And of course, an awful lot of their parody, they don't even have to work hard to get to there, because all of us have been saying, if you want us to be driving electric cars, and Americans are buying 16 million gas and diesel cars and a quarter of a million electric cars, and you want that jumped up to 5 or 10 million cars a year, where are we going to get the juice? And I get the answer back from a lot of liberals. I hate to say it, but it's very simplistic. It's like a child's understanding of something. If daddy needs more money, you just go to the ATM and it hands you money. If you need electricity, you just plug it into the wall and the electricity is there. Have they figured out, have we confronted a notion that if almost a third of America's electric car, a power of our grid nationwide comes from coal, and a certain percentage from nat gas, which the greenies also hate, and then a certain percentage from nuclear, which they won't even consider as one of the replacement sources, and that we're tearing out dams, to some extent we're reducing hydro, and certainly not advancing any new hydro, where the heck is the juice going to come from to make these cars run?
Well, in a kind of circular argument, the serious greens claim that we'll build lots more windmills and solar arrays, and of course, everyone knows the sun and wind don't appear all the time. So what you'll do in their world vision is build lots more, you can guess it, batteries to store the electricity on the grid for when you need it to charge your battery-powered car. That's the concept, the vision, which has been seriously proposed. But let's be clear about one thing. It isn't impossible to do that. It's just nuts. I mean, you can do a lot of things. So it's not impossible to build enough batteries. It's just crazy. And let me give you an idea how crazy it is at the grid scale. So you put your finger on something. You plug a car into the grid. You're charging whatever the average electricity is. In America, that's roughly 70% either a combination of coal and natural gas. Slightly more natural gas than coal nationally. Depends where you live. And then, you know, as you pointed out, about 20% nukes. So on the margin, you have this 8% that's wind and solar, and the rest is the stuff that nobody likes in the green community. They want to change that, and they want to store the electricity in batteries. Here, I'm going to use the expression again. Here's the deal. Imagine that the wind doesn't blow for a day or two.
Yeah.
Be calm. It happens all the time for a day or two. Imagine there's no significant sunlight for a day or two, including when there's forest fires in the daytime or rain, which happens all the time. You'd have to store roughly 2 days' worth of electricity in batteries if that's what your plan is to do. How many batteries does that represent? That run back to your arithmetic, which is is actually important to use. So the biggest battery factory in America, and still the biggest one in the world, is Elon Musk's Gigafactory in Nevada. It makes all the batteries for Teslas. It's right. A massive factory. You see pictures of it. If you use a magic Google machine to look at drone pictures of it, it's enormous, much bigger than many shopping malls combined. The output of that one factory, this billion-dollar-plus factory, it would have to operate for 500 years to produce enough batteries for 2 days of the grid storage.
So, all right, then, since you're a technical guy, let me ask you about something else, and that is pumped storage, because I hear people say, well, it doesn't all have to be batteries. We can pump water uphill and it'll run down. I said, yeah, there are utilities that do that for peaking power right now. But it's also, one, expensive. Two, you can't do it in every geography because some geography lends itself. Northern California, I think, has a couple of these where they have a convenient hill nearby, maybe even a lake. They pump a bunch of water up when the energy is somewhat cheaper at night, and then they let it run downhill when everybody turns on their blow dryers and their toaster ovens to make breakfast, and they get some peaked storage, but it's hugely expensive. And I also have to tell them, you know, and again, this is where I'm weaker, Mark. All the laws of thermodynamics that say when we take electricity and put it into a motor to run a pump to pump water uphill, there's loss in every one of those. When we run the water back downhill and it runs through another reverse pump, basically a Pelton wheel or something, into a generator, there's more loss there. And then when we transmit it a couple of hundred miles to wherever the electricity, there's loss there. And then when we put it into a charger, there's some loss there. And then it goes into a battery that you may put 10 kilowatt into, but you don't necessarily get 10 kilowatt out. Whereas when I put 10 gallons of gas in my gas tank, I get 10 gallons worth of fuel. You don't get that with a... Can you speak to some of these loss issues? Because I know they may get a little thick for some people and some people's eyes glaze over, but I think they're actually important because they say, well, we'll just pump storage. And you say, but A, the capital cost, B, the losses.
Well, you know, Shazam, Gomer, y'all just did a high school physics lesson. That's good. It's because you nailed it. Look, all energy transformations cost energy. So that's the way of saying that, as you pointed out, they have losses. You can't, this is a basic law of thermodynamics. You're absolutely right. You convert energy from one form to another, you lose energy in that process. It's always the case. It's impossible to avoid in the universe we live in. So you're right. Pump storage has that problem. All storage has that problem. The least energy costly storage is storing oil in a tank. It's just flat out that's not true. The least costly storage is a pile of coal sitting in a coal yard. That's very cheap in energy in dollar terms. The most costly storage, at the far end of the spectrum, are batteries. But you're right, you have an energy cost. It's roughly 20% of your energy is lost in the round trip of making electricity, put water up a hill and bring it back down and make it to electricity. So it's, you can maybe, you know, get systems that are 10 or 15% thrown away, but that's a rule of thumb. So you have losses. But the biggest problem is one you put your finger on, is that you don't have many places where there's useful pumped hydro. Pumped hydro means you have to have a high head, a long way up from the where you're pumping the water from to, because you need gravity to pull it back down. You need a long distance to get the energy recovered. So there aren't many big hydro dams where you can do this in the world, and the ones that we've built are probably the only ones we're ever going to build, none of the environmental community, and most people don't want to build more hydro dams, and there aren't many places to build them in America now anyway. So it's not a solution broadly for the country. It's not even an expandable solution for California because they want to tear hydro dams down. But the energy cost of batteries, incidentally, is similar. You roughly throw away 10 or 20% of the energy round trips, depending on the battery, depending how you charge it. And some batteries are a little better. Some might only have, 8 or 9% thrown away. But you're using energy to store energy. But here's another part of the hidden use of energy to store energy. It takes energy to fabricate a steel tank to store oil, not a lot per unit of oil stored. It takes energy to fabricate a battery. It takes a lot. To build enough batteries that can store the equivalent of one barrel of oil, to build that many batteries requires consuming 100 to 300 barrels of oil of energy.
Wow.
To make the battery.
I'm talking to Mark Mills, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with Mark Mills, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, Faculty Fellow at Northwestern University's McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science. He's written a lot, and most recently I saw a piece that he'd done. He's on the show before, but Daily Caller piece, The Green New Deal Cannot Break the Laws of Physics. And so, Mark, you're telling us that even if, as you and I are talking today, Joe Biden is elected president, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the great scientist who graduated with an economics degree from Boston University, I'm being sarcastic, Boston University, that even if we pour $93 trillion that we don't have into the Green New Deal, the math and the science of it does not work. So what can we tell the people who... Look, I have no problem with solar. I actually use some solar, but I've told people I wouldn't use it till it penciled. And for most situations, most people, it doesn't pencil. And they say, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, if Mark Mills, you know, over at Northwestern offered to sell me a machine that made gasoline, I might be interested. But the minute he tells me that my capital and operating costs will mean that I'll be making gasoline at $10 a gallon out of his magic machine when I can buy it down the street for, even in the Pacific Northwest, $3 a gallon, I ain't going to buy the machine because it doesn't make financial sense. That's what I mean by penciling. Is there a way to make much of any of this actually pencil out?
Well, we know one answer is yes. As long as the government, using other people's money, hands you that $10 for each gallon, which is what's going on with subsidies. So if the market is giving you money that's courtesy of other people, it pencils out. But that's subsidy structure can't survive forever. It can survive for a while. We've been doing this for quite a few years. Europe is still doing it. So the assertion is that this stuff, wind, solar, and batteries, are going to get so much cheaper that we won't have to subsidize them soon. We know that's not true, and the easy test for this is not a physics test. It's a political test. Every time anybody proposes to end the subsidies for wind and solar, you have never seen such a fusillade of lobbying in Washington to protect the subsidies. It is epic protection of these subsidies. This is the truth that we do know, is that Europe is further ahead of us in installing wind and solar combined on their grids. We also know that has directly led to the cost of electricity now being three times higher than America's in places like Germany. They triple the cost of American electricity outside of California. 300% increase as we add more wind and solar. It's a stunning cost. It's not cheap. It is cheaper than it used to be, and you're absolutely right. There are many places and significant applications globally, really tremendously significant applications globally for wind and solar. But it won't replace coal, oil, and gas at any time frames that have any meaning. And by that I mean not decades, probably centuries. That's just the reality of where we are. And this is not me saying it. Incidentally, the International Energy Agency, which is a full-on supporter and promoter of the Green New Deals and all their forms around the world, has a new forecast that came out with. And even in their most aggressive wish list forecasts, in the year 2040, oil, gas, and coal still provide 70% of the world's energy. That's hardly a transition.
No, it's not. And by the way, you've pointed out in some of what you've written, this is where we get into sort of the ugly side. You talk about the ugly side of all the mining that's required. Now, I don't have a problem with mining, but if somebody says 500,000 pounds, was it 500,000 pounds or tons of dirt that you have to move to get the material for one battery, you also point out that some of the key ingredients like cobalt come from some truly ugly parts of the world that do ugly things to children.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I used to work for a mining company in my impetuous youth in Canada, and I like mining. I've been to the bottom of a 7,000-foot vertical shaft in the Granite Shield in northern Canada. It's really amazing what miners do. And we have no choice but to mine things. Everything on the planet, everything in society, everything we have is built from some minerals, materials we take out of the earth, and that's without exception, right? I mean, trees grow by extracting more efficiently than we do minerals and materials from the ground. That's how they grow.
That's why we live in wood houses.
It's really, it's quasi-theological. It's really miraculous when you think about it. The minerals and the elements that we use to make all the magical things we have, you know, cobalt and these weird elements, you know, the rare earth dysprosium and neodymium, these cool names, they were forged in the heart of a star, you know, billions of years ago, and they never disappear. They're here forever, and we can reuse them over and over again. They really are recyclable in that sense. They last in the universe that we live in for essentially infinite time. It's just amazing. But it takes machines and energy to coax them out of the ground and the rocks where they're hidden and convert them into things. And unfortunately, a lot of mining around the world, in places like Congo, where roughly two-thirds, well, I think it's more like 60% now, 60% of the world's cobalt is mined in Congo. And Congo is notorious for having child labor, kids using shovels and hands and carrying bags of rocks. I mean, it really is despicable. And, the problem we've got is we don't have an easy mechanism. We can't go and take over the Congo and make them do things. If we demand more cobalt, and we won't mine it here, no one wants to do that in our political system, we'll be importing it from somewhere. And you can't easily have a conflict-free, remember conflict-free diamonds?
Oh, yeah.
Very hard to make conflict-free minerals because in economics, the word fungible, it's very fungible. You can't tell where the atoms came from in the end. And if we push demand as high as we're going to push demand with green deals, in fact, a number of the UN agencies have pointed out what they're worried about is a so-called gold rush for energy minerals going into fragile ecosystems around the world where there are weak legal and social protections against destroying the land and landscape. I would worry, too, if I were an environmentalist. I would think this, I am an environmentalist. Who isn't? I'm talking about the political environmentalists.
Right.
You should be worried about that. That's not a good thing. And if you really want green stuff here, my bottom line is very easy since it's a political season. For every extra dollar we want to subsidize a green machine, batteries, wind, solar, we should require one extra pound of minerals to be mined in America.
We actually have things like these rare earths. I always start with germanium, and then I run out because my list in my head doesn't go that far. But let's say all the fancy stuff that makes your smartphone work and your fancy TV on the wall work, that comes from rare earths, which, as I understand, 90% comes from China. So if we truly embraced the Green New Deal, and said, okay, we're going to go wind, solar, lots of batteries, that by definition, because of the laws in the United States that are not likely to change, we're going to become much more dependent on communist China for all of this, right?
Well, and not just China, but also Russia and many African nations. Some of the nations that mine this stuff still and sell it to us are friendly to us, Australia and Canada. I'm Canadian. I like Canadian mines, but an awful lot of them aren't. One of the biggest nickel mines in the world is a Russian mine in Siberia, maybe the second largest nickel mine in the world. And they had a massive oil spill this past summer, the second biggest Arctic oil spill ever since the Exxon Valdez. Didn't make much news. Nobody cares. But in service of more nickel for making more batteries, nickel is a key element in batteries, we get it from there. The United States has always had massive mineral resources. The United States was the largest source of the rare earth elements in the world in the 90s. Rare earths are interesting, by the way. They aren't rare. They have rare properties. They're very common all over the world, but they're just have rare properties. They make magnets extremely powerful. The rare earth element called neodymium makes magnets, and as does dysprosium makes magnets able and motors able to handle far higher temperatures, which is important when you have a car and electric drives. We could mine more. We should mine more, and we need to mine more even if we don't have a Green New Deal because we've become 100% dependent on imports for something like 20 of our key minerals that we need, and we get more than half of all of our key minerals by imports for like another dozen to two dozen.
I'm talking to Mark Mills. We're going to be back in just a moment. Mark Mills is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, also at Northwestern University, at the McCormick School of Engineering, and importantly enough, Applied Science. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Yeah. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a real pleasure to have Mark Mills with me from Northwestern University, from the Manhattan Institute, the average voter out there. And they hit me with questions all the time, and some of them I can answer, and some are at your level, and I couldn't begin to answer them. So this is so terribly important that we arm people up with these pieces of information. So when their friends start saying, well, I've got a Tesla or I've got a Leaf and it works great and everybody should have one, that I want people to be capable of not just saying, well, that's stupid, but saying, here's what you should understand went into that, that you don't even know went into it.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting because I found most people that aren't zealots are receptive and they understand when you tell them facts. Especially if you tell them the facts in a sort of non-political way. This is not a red or green, a blue team versus issue. It's become red team, blue team, as you know. But
yep.
Where do you want to get the stuff? I mean, I like you said, I've said many speeches and places. I like windmills. I like electric cars. I think Tesla's impressive. Really good for him. I mean, the subsidy part I'm not happy about, but it's an impressive car. Give him credit.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted with the fact that I have a tech executive building machines. For goodness sake, all the rest of these dweebs are, you know, mouth breathers doing Twitter. Come on. This is great. But
well,
the morality of it that offends me, and I like you, have said many places I keep, I have to begin speeches by saying I'm not in opposition to a technology. I'm in opposition to the immorality of reverse Robin Hood. I'm in opposition to taking from the poor and giving to the rich. This offends me. I'm in opposition to enslaving children to serve, you know, your smartphones. I just think this is terrible. We have, you know, could you pay more for your smartphone battery? Sure, why not? I mean, the truth is the amount of cobalt you need for that is so small, you could triple the cost of cobalt. It wouldn't make any difference. But it sure would for a Tesla. I mean, these big batteries can't tolerate high mineral costs. So, now, I think it's important. It's a little disheartening when you look at the polling data, when you see that Republican millennials, 80% of them, want the government to do more subsidies for alternative energy and more about climate change. I mean, which explains why even our best allies in politics are very reluctant to take these issues on because they know what the polls show. They want to just the basic answer when I meet with these, you know, their staff or some of them is give me an answer, give me something I can do so I can look like I'm part of the solution for the problem. And they don't want to be told there isn't a problem with climate. They want to be told that they got a solution, which is why they support the subsidies. Why it keeps happening. It'll keep happening too, unfortunately.
Can I ask you about two other things real quick? And I'll make them quick.
Sure.
A few years ago, I read about ammonia, and there was somebody who was pushing the idea that on the Columbia River dams, that if you want a way to store, instead of using storage where basically you make the water levels go up and down the river, which everybody thinks doesn't cause a problem, it does cause problems with riverbank erosion and all kinds of things. And they said, you can take electricity and fairly readily turn it into ammonia. And what I didn't realize, you can run a diesel engine or a version of a diesel engine on ammonia. So you basically could have giant tanks full of ammonia that would then, when you need the power, run back through generators. And it would be a zero carbon storage system. Does that, and yet I tell people, if you don't see somebody using it on a big scale, there's likely a physics reason for it, like thorium reactors and why they're not being used. Does that stuff work? And is there any possible application where they say for a battery, we're going to just make ammonia? And I was amazed that you could burn ammonia in a diesel engine, but apparently you can.
Well, diesel engines are pretty magical. You can run a properly designed diesel almost any liquid that's combustible. It just has to have a flash point. And that's why, I've been doing some reading and some history for my next book. I did some reading of what Rudolf Diesel did and when he did it. And it was really quite a story. It really is. And it was a sad story because he built the world's first diesel engine. That's why it's named after him. But they didn't have materials that could stand the pressures needed, the temperatures, when he invented it.
Oh, but we do now, don't we?
Well, it took 20 years before high-strength steel came along and people could build them, but his patent had expired by then, and he, I think, died a poor man, desolate. And, I mean, it was really pretty pathetic. But your instincts are correct. You can store electricity in a lot of intermediate forms easily. You know, storing it as electrons is hard, because those are capacitors, and they're the only way to store. Well, that's not true. You can store electricity in a superconducting coil, but you know enough about those costs to know that doesn't cost that pencil
doesn't make sense.
But capacitors are the only things that store electricity as electrons. Otherwise, you have to make them into an intermediate form. You either make a chemical, you could heat something up, cool something down, create pressure, move water uphill, make it, all these things. You got the Fred Flintstone solutions that you've seen going around where they want to use cranes to lift rocks up next to wind turbines and let them come down.
Yeah.
It's really nutty. But all of them have inefficiencies built into the conversion processes. So making chemicals is very chemical production is the most energy intensive industry in America. It's the largest consumer of industrial energy in the United States, bigger than steel. There's a reason for that. Making chemicals requires energy. So making ammonia consumes energy. So your round trip losses are extraordinarily high. The machinery is complex. And it's expensive, so it adds to the costs. So, another version of this, the simpler one, is people want to use wind turbines to make hydrogen by electrolyzing water when you don't need the wind electricity. So
right.
they operate in this theory, which is a pretty good theory. If I built a wind turbine and I'm being paid for its electricity for when it operates, and if that's sufficient to pay for the whole cost of the wind turbine.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show, and I'll be glad to take your phone calls and even naysayer calls if you disagree with my point of view. But let me ask you a rhetorical question. It goes this way. Does the Constitution only protect your religious rights within your house, your church, your synagogue, or your mosque? Or are you allowed in America and protected from government interference if you decide to take your faith anywhere you want to take it? Now, along with that, one of the other of the Bill of Rights, does the Second Amendment give you the right to carry a gun, keep and bear arms only inside your own home, or does it allow you to go pretty much anywhere you want to go and have those Second Amendment rights protected outside your front door? I thought I'd give that question to Amy Swearer, who's a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And Amy, it's good to have you back on the program. The Supreme Court has said it will take this question up when it starts its new term in October because they need summers off. After all, they're so overworked. Joe Biden's getting them, he's going to try and get them 4 extra justices because they're so swamped that they only get a 3-month summer vacation, almost 4-month summer vacation every year. You can tell they're just buried in work, so they can't get to this one till October. Would you give me your point? Yeah. I know I can be insulting to the Supreme Court because they make me mad sometimes. You may have to be a little more discreet about it, but give me your point of view on that.
Well, first of all, let's put it this way. It's taken them 13 years since District of Columbia v. Heller to even take on a Second Amendment case. So, frankly, I'm a little happy waiting until even October since they finally took one. And this is a good case. As you mentioned, it's a case out of New York that deals with, at its core, the issue of whether the Second Amendment means what it says when it says that there is a right to both keep and bear arms. So New York, like several other very gun control restrictive states, basically says that there is no right for ordinary law-abiding citizens to carry guns outside the home. In theory, you can apply for a concealed carry permit, but in practice, unless you show some extremely what they call good cause above and beyond, just general fear of crime and wanting to be able to protect yourself, you're not considered qualified to get that permit. And in fact, when you read some of these denials from New York, they basically come down to, well, have you tried being robbed more often? have you tried being a victim of crime more recently? And maybe if that's the case, then we'll give you a concealed carry permit. So that's what this case is about. The Supreme Court finally, 250 plus years after ratification and 13 years after it's finally said, yes, there is an individual right. It's finally taking up this question, which, again, at its core is just, is there a right to bear arms outside the home? Can states just say, no, you can't bear arms outside the home under any capacity? We're not going to give you a license.
See, I don't live inside the district like Amy does, soon to be the 51st state if Joe Biden gets his way. And I don't live in New York, although I visited there. But I'm trying to imagine some poor guy or gal who walks around with $500,000 worth of diamonds because their business is in the diamond district. And they go in and say, look, I'm carrying $500,000 worth of merchandise that doesn't have VIN numbers on it. Could you give me the right to protect myself? They say, no, not until somebody hits you over the head first. This seems like one of those cases where the court, not the liberals on it, but the conservatives on it would just say, well, of course you have a right to have Second Amendment rights outside your home. What kind of argument is the other side going to say to defend the idea that your First Amendment rights are restricted to inside the bounds of your house?
Yeah, so this is something where, I mean, I think we already have sort of a heads up about what the counter argument is, because we've seen these cases come up at the lower courts so many times. And it basically boils down to this. Well, forget about the text for a minute. When it says bear arms, what it actually means is if you get called up for militia duty. I mean, we know you said Supreme Court that it's an individual right, but not the bear arms part. So we're just going to ignore that. And then they'll go through this sort of pseudo historical analysis and sort of take out some laws from the 19th century in some states, and sometimes not even states. They'll go to like the Wild West, places that technically were not even under the jurisdiction of, you know, the federal or state constitutions, and they'll say, well, some of these states had some sorts of laws restricting carry. You know, they said you either had to get a permit for concealed carry, or, you know, there were restrictions on where you could carry. But what they don't tell you, after pointing all of this out, is that even where there were concealed carry permitting procedures, one, it said nothing about open carry. Open carry, which was the common mode at the time, was perfectly legal, so you still had a right to carry, which you do not in places like New York today. And then the other thing they don't tell you is the racist history of many of these carry laws. They actually come into being specifically as ways to make sure that the freedmen essentially knew their place, you know, that they couldn't go around carrying guns to defend themselves in the post-Civil War South.
Freed black men. Let's put the emphasis on that.
Yes.
So are we going to see the Biden DOJ weigh in with an amicus brief and say, this is why, you know, it was really sensible. We kept guns, the Democrat Party kept guns away from black people in the 1800s, and we want to keep them away from black people today. Because that's effectively what it does, right?
Oh, it is effectively what it does. I mean, you look at in practice today in places like L.A. County, for example, and even in New York City, you know, who is being granted these concealed carry permits? And it routinely shows that it's disproportionately rich, white, well-connected individuals. And it's not in any way, shape, or form reflective of one who's actually, you know, disproportionately at risk of being harmed by violent crime, which, again, is statistically people of color who live in poorer neighborhoods. And it also doesn't reflect even generally the demographics of these areas. So, you know, again, when you have these laws, it's still in practice, even not in theory, works to deprive poorer people of color specifically of their constitutional rights.
Now, I get 6 hours a day to sound off. The attorneys who stand in front of the court to make the argument for and against are only going to get, what, 30 minutes or so? So they can't pack everything in there. But can they raise some of those issues? The gun control laws were, at their heart, racist, and that they would have the same kinds of implications today? Meaning if you're poor and you're black and you live in a lousy part of New York City, you're going to have one heck of a time getting it. But if you're a friend of Bill de Blasio or Andrew Cuomo, you're probably going to not have a problem at all.
Yeah, so these are exactly the type of arguments that I would anticipate coming up, again, both in the briefs, so the written format, the written submissions, but then again at oral argument, because all of this touches on, I think, what is really the test that the court has put forward, which is, you know, what is the text, history, and tradition? So you get the text, which clearly says there's a right to bear arms, and then you get the history and tradition of the right, which is, you know, as long as you were considered a full-fledged American citizen, you had some capacity to bear arms.
That's Amy Swearer from the Heritage Foundation. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails right to me at talk@LarsLarson.com. In the last few years, we've seen this really disturbing shift in American society, and I thought, well, it's one thing for public opinion to shift, but when you find that politicians are trying to force that shift through things like critical race theory, anti-racism, a lot of things that maybe even sound good on paper until you find out the nasty details. But you wonder. When I was a kid, I was taught by my mom. Mom was a good church-going lady, and she taught me that I should be colorblind, that I should not make my friends or make my decisions based on the color of somebody's skin, but as Dr. King once said, based on the content of that person's character. Richard Bernstein has written, I think, an amazing essay about this. He's the former Beijing bureau chief for Time magazine and now a contributing writer at Real Clear Investigations. Richard, welcome back to the program. And you see this shift as America losing its ability or has abandoned its aim of being colorblind toward all citizens?
Well, it's certainly a big step in that direction, Lars, and thanks for having me on. This has been brewing in the academic world for a long time, and the idea behind it is that colorblindness doesn't work because it doesn't take into account how disadvantaged some minorities are, especially African Americans, and that we have to do more than simply treat everybody, give everybody the same opportunity. We have to find ways to promote African Americans, especially Hispanics, other minorities, by giving them sort of special treatment. In other words, and now we have the new thing here is that corporate America is buying into this idea, and many, many companies are setting up racial quotas and hiring and that sort of thing.
Racial quotas are unconstitutional, aren't they? I mean, the Supreme Court's kind of danced around it, saying you can be affirmative action. You can say, if I have the choice of two candidates and they're both about equivalent in skills and talents, I can hire the person of color, and that's affirmative action. But they're going beyond that. Anti-racism, at least the way Ibram Kendi positions it, is you have to actively discriminate against white people based on their skin color. And I can't imagine is that ever going to be seen as constitutional or legal in this country?
Probably. That I'm not an expert on the legality of it, but common sense tells me that no, that's not going to become legal. But there's going to be this gray area where companies, schools operate in that way by essentially discriminating against white people in favor of non-white people. And, you know, the ideology behind this now is that colorblindness kind of supports systemic racism and white supremacy. It's a ploy used by white supremacy to maintain its position. So we have to treat people.
Does it actually do that? I mean, every time somebody says, well, if you grow up disadvantaged and black, you're likely to never, you know, be able to do anything because you've got all the cards against you. And I said, you mean like Dr. Ben Carson, who became a neurosurgeon and a cabinet secretary, who grew up with a mom who couldn't even read very well, but made him do book reports? And you say, well, yeah, except for him and all the other people like him who persevered despite the tough conditions they were in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The whole ideology, the whole movement makes you think that this is the United States in 1925 or maybe 1950, not 2021. I mean, we've the last 50 or 60 years, there's been a strenuous effort already to redress the racial imbalance. You just wouldn't know that, listening to the proponents of critical race theory and the idea of systemic racism holding people back. It has the effect of kind of removing the whole notion of personal responsibility from the individual's shoulders by making young minorities feel that, well, they're victims of systemic racism, so what can they do about it anyway?
Well, and when you do that, what kind of situation do you create, not just for today, but for 10 or 20 or 30 years from now? If you've got kids in school being taught by their teachers, if you have white skin, you're part of the oppressor class. And these kids over here with brown and black skin, they are the people you are oppressing, and they are victims. So we don't expect much from them. They're victims. And you're the oppressor just because you have white skin. Where does that put us 30 or 40 years from now when people are taught your skin color defines who you are? Because I thought that was what we were trying to get away from.
Yeah. Well, we were. We can hope that we will again. I mean, I think that the 20 or 30 years from now, it really becomes almost a national security issue. One of the examples that I talk about in my article in Real Clear Investigations is the really kind of a war against the notion of giftedness in math. And the move in several states, including California, to eliminate gifted programs, acceleration, separate classes for more talented students in math, to have all the students grouped together somehow on the grounds that this is going to magically produce better results for everybody. The United States is already way, way below international standards in tests of school kids in math and science. Situation was already not very good. And, this kind of wokefulness is going to make it even worse. And, I think there's a genuine danger. I know this is going to sound a little extreme, but I think there's a general real danger that this could erode American leadership in math and science.
I think it would among other things, one of the dirty little secrets in education is that Asian kids as a group tend to do better, than white kids, brown kids, and black kids. And you say, well, we can't have that. We can't have programs that mostly benefit, and yet that there's a racial minority which has taken its share of knocks in this country, unfairly so, and they have been discriminated against, and yet when their kids do well, and they say, now my kid can get into a good college, and you say, no, you can't. If your child were brown or black, another racial minority group, those test scores would get you anywhere you want to go. But since you're Asian, we're going to actually actively discriminate against you, as some of the top colleges in America have been doing for the last 10 or 20 years.
Yes. Well, the Asian success story, really kind of throws the whole woke ideology into disarray because, on the one hand, they want to say that people of color are at a systemic disadvantage. And then you have people, as you say, who have suffered discrimination in the past who collectively are doing very well. So the woke answer to that is, well, we're talking about people from wealthy backgrounds who are highly educated, and therefore they already have an advantage over African Americans who often come from economically very disadvantaged families. Their parents don't have the means to give them, enhance their education. And, there's some truth to that. There's always a little bit of truth to the woke ideology. But the fact is that a lot of these Asians are also coming from, very modest backgrounds.
You got to read this whole piece, this whole essay by Richard Bernstein, who's at Real Clear Investigations now. He's the former Beijing bureau chief for Time magazine. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls. We'll get to those in just a minute at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers always go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. If there's one thing that I think I can accurately say is in extraordinarily short supply in every city and every state in the great United States of America, it's foster care for foster kids. I have yet to run into a state that says, oh, we've got so many foster families out there, we can't find enough kids to put kids into those foster families. No, instead, there's a shortage. And now it seems that there are groups trying to make sure that there's an even greater shortage, and they're going to do it in the name of political correctness. Sarah Perry is a legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Sarah, I've been following this case involving the city of Philadelphia, where the city stuck its nose in and told Catholic Social Services, we're not going to let you place kids anymore. Would you mind giving my audience a little bit of the legal background behind what Catholic Social Services was doing and why the city of Philadelphia thought it was necessary to intercede in this, especially in light of the vast shortage of foster families around America?
Yes, and Lars, that's interesting because really the facts of this case are critical to an understanding of why it's so important. Back in 2018, there were no issues with Catholic Social Services conducting their foster agency work. They have been sponsored by the Catholic Archdiocese in Philadelphia, which had been doing foster care work for 200 years in Philadelphia. But a Philadelphia Inquirer reporter discovered that there were a number of agencies that refused to foster to same-sex couples based on their religious convictions. Well, one of the foster agencies decided to fold and change their operating regulations to accept same-sex couples. But Catholic Social Services held fast. They said, we are sponsored by the Catholic Church and the Archdiocese. This is against our belief. These are sincerely held religious beliefs. We've always done it this way. So in response, the city of Philadelphia issued a non-discrimination ordinance and said, we won't renew our contract with you unless you're willing to sign on. And naturally, the non-discrimination ordinance included their acquiescence to fostering regardless of gender identity or sexual orientation. Well, when you are an observant Catholic organization, that tends to be a bit of a problem. So they actually filed suit along with some individual foster parents against the city of Philadelphia. They lost at the district court level. They lost again at the Third Circuit level. So now we have heard from both sides on this issue. We had oral arguments back in November of 2020, and we are down to the wire. There are 18 cases remaining on the Supreme Court's docket. We are racing to the end of the term, and we're wondering if there's going to be an avalanche of decisions this coming Thursday, which is their next release date. And one of those issues we are expecting to be this particular case, which is going to really impact the state of religious liberty in America, specifically whether or not you can participate in a government program if it requires violating your religious convictions. That's the ultimate question here.
I mean, because I know there are going to be people hearing this, Sarah, who say, but it's discrimination. I say, you mean like telling farmers, if you're black, you'll have your farm loans forgiven, as the Biden administration is doing. But if you're white, you don't get them forgiven. Or, and Sarah, years ago, I did some stories on a family that was trying to adopt a child, and the child happened to be an Indian child, and they were a perfect family. I mean, they were just, I mean, you couldn't have, you know, taken one out of Norman Rockwell better. And the government came in and said, nope, we have to base the adoption on, you know, because these were foster care parents who were taking care of a kid. Mom was dead. Dad was dead, both from drugs, drugs and going to prison and all the rest of this. And this family said, we've had this child with us for 2 years. He fits in so well with our other children. And they said, nope, we've got to place him based on genetics. And they stuck him with two grandparents who were in a terrible situation. They were in their either early 70s or late 60s, and they didn't have room. But genetically, he belongs there. We have laws about that mandate that Indian children are returned to an Indian family, even if it's not an ideal situation. So, and aren't there other organizations that say we particularly cater to, you know, providing adoptions for gay couples or for, you know, couples with all kinds of other characteristics that are ordinarily off limits and you can't discriminate based on, but they say we do this because we fit a niche. It's not like the service was denied to anybody. You could go and get it from but they're saying either fall in line and give up your religious beliefs or you can no longer place foster kids for the city of Philadelphia. Am I wrong about any of that?
No, you're not. In fact, there are 30 providers in the city of Philadelphia that specifically deal with adoption and fostering children. There were actually no complainants, no same-sex couples that had been denied service by CSS, as opposed to Masterpiece Cake Shop, where we have Jack Phillips, who is dealing with an individual complainant who's gone to get a cake that won't be baked for him because of religious convictions. There were no complainants. So when the petitioners here went into the city and they met with a city official, they were told in no uncertain terms, get with the times on the same-sex marriage issue. Now, we knew this was coming. Back in Obergefell v. Hodges in 2015, the seminal
That's the gay marriage case. Yep.
The gay marriage case. We knew, based on what Justice Roberts was saying, Justice Alito hinted at, that these were going to be coming storms. Where does benefits for a government program come down in relation to religion if beliefs on same-sex marriage and gender identity are concerned? They foretold this problem. We're just seeing the most current iteration. We've dealt with it in Hobby Lobby with the abortion and contraception mandate. Those were religious petitioners. They were participating in a government program. Masterpiece Cake Shop, again, that was a religious individual who did not decide that he was going to provide a wedding service to individuals because of his religious convictions. But here we have the crash of same-sex marriage, religion, and government program. So all three of these have come to a bit of a head. We know that there is significant case law that argues for, among other things, the overturning of a case called Employment Division versus Smith. Now, why is this important?
Oh, I think I remember. Is this the peyote case?
This is the peyote case. Very good, Laura.
Okay, very good. Jeez. Now, it's from my backyard, so I know what I know a bit about it.
It formed the basis of our modern free exercise jurisprudence, and it was so concerning that Congress in 1993 responded with an almost unanimous passage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and that protects the expression within federal law of individuals' religious freedom. Now, Congress is currently attempting to gut RFRA through the Equality Act, but that's a different show for a different day. What the petitioners here have asked is, listen, maybe it's time to revisit Employment Division versus Smith. Maybe it wasn't such a good opinion after all. And I love Justice Scalia. This would be one of his opinions that I've actually taken issue with. So they said to the government, they said to the courts, listen, we want an answer on Employment Division versus Smith, number one. And number two, participate in a government program.
You broke up a little bit there, but Sarah, I'm going to be watching. Do you have a read on the court, real quick? Do you have a read on which direction they're going to go if they release it Thursday?
I am cautiously optimistic. We could get a supermajority, a 6-3 conservative majority. Barrett was very tight-lipped during oral arguments, but I like what Kavanaugh said. He said Philly was out to pick a fight. Justice Alito said, listen, this is all about you not believing what they believe.
Absolutely right. That's Sarah Perry from the Heritage Foundation. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Joe Biden needs to tell Americans what his national security strategy is. And I could cite a number of examples just in the first, say, 10 months he's been in office, not even 10 months at this point, that there have been things that he has done with our national security that make absolutely no sense. Well, I thought we'd talk about that with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, who's an expert in national security and foreign policy with the Heritage Foundation. Colonel, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
So tell me this. Does Joe Biden have a national security strategy at all that you can tell?
Well, just so, you know, for folks who don't do this stuff every day, what a strategy is a president sitting back and says, what are the ends? What are we trying to accomplish? What are the ways? How are we going to accomplish that? And what means are we going to use to do that? And you combine that together, looking at all the things that a president has at his disposal, from the military to diplomacy to economic levers. And it's, you know, how am I going to protect America's interests in the world? It's the answer to that question. So, there is a strategy. It's actually Obama's strategy. So I'm not really kind of holding my breath for the document because I know exactly what it's going to say. It's going to say we're going to do all the stuff Obama did, which, by the way, didn't work. But just to give folks an indication of the priority of the president for the importance of doing this, because that, you know, he is the commander in chief and everything else, is we have a gender strategy. So we have a strategy on how we're going to enforce diversity on America. We have two climate change strategies, but we don't have a national security strategy or a national defense strategy.
I mean, and what you just said makes perfect sense, and a lot of us are viewing this as the third term of Obama. But, for example, with Afghanistan, you say we want to keep America safe. And you say, well, Afghanistan has nothing to do with that. Well, I think it does, because you exit quickly, you arm the Taliban, and then you bring a bunch of people to the United States who are not properly vetted, but are already on our shores in many cases. And all of these folks are inside our borders, and there may be more coming in. Because the Taliban now has more resources available to it. It doesn't exactly like the United States. And we have a wide open southern border. To me, that sounds like if the Taliban decides they want to put people on American soil, perhaps even armed, perhaps even equipped and funded, that they can do it. And if they do that, that's dangerous. So your end is keep America safe. Your ways, well, have an unguarded southern border, have a bad outcome in Afghanistan, arm up the Taliban. Just as one example, that doesn't seem like it fits anything, not even Obama's strategies, does it, Colonel?
Well, so that gets to the second point. Look, we know what Obama's strategy is going to be, which is that you placate, you appease, you ignore your enemies, one, because you want to focus on consolidating domestic political power, but two, because you think if you're nice to your enemies, they'll just leave you alone. And now, look, we know that strategy is going to fail. And we know Biden's going to implement that strategy because the same people that are running this administration are the one that ran the Obama administration. But the reason why we're failing now actually gets to the second point, which is Biden's a terrible leader who makes terrible decisions. You know, Abraham Lincoln had difficulty finding a good strategy, but he was a determined, aggressive leader, and he won the war. You can have a great strategy and a terrible leader, and you're still going to be in bad shape. In this case, we have an unworkable strategy, but we actually have an even worse and less capable leader who seems like genetically committed to making really bad decisions.
Well, like Bob Gates has said famously, that Joe Biden got every major foreign policy decision of his entire career wrong every single time. So he's consistent. But let me throw Iran out there as an example. Under Trump, Iran was put on, they were basically over a barrel. They were economically in really bad shape. And Joe Biden came in and immediately eased the pressure on them. And the first thing the mad mullahs told him was, yeah, we'll sit down and talk, but we're going to get an even better deal this time around than the one we got from from Obama, when Obama was sending him planes full of money and handing back cash that they didn't own, you know, that just saying, here, let's give him a lot of cash. Let's be nice to him. Let's let him do whatever they're doing and get a nuke. In 10 years, I won't be president. I'll be a multi-millionaire by then. So who cares? And now Joe Biden comes in and at this point doesn't have a deal with Iran. And hasn't even gone back to the bad Obama deal. He apparently wants to get one that's even worse.
Yeah, so let me tell you how this ends. One is, he gets a deal, and as soon as he does, everybody will think problem solved. But, of course, that'll just mean that Iran will get more aggressive, more faster, more difficult, and the chaos will come sooner. Two is, he doesn't get a deal, and they half-heartedly try to contain Iran, and it moves forward. And here's where it winds up, one of two ways. One way is Israel's just going to attack Iran and blow up their nuclear capabilities.
That's the plan B they've been talking about lately?
That's the Israelis are not going to stand by and allow Iran to become a nuclear power, and they'll attack them. That's the good scenario. The other scenario is, for some reason, they don't. Maybe a president constrains them, or maybe they just get cold feet or something.
Colonel, I'm up against the clock, but I so appreciate what you do at Heritage. Thanks so much for your service in uniform, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That is Jim Carafano, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, expert in national security and foreign policy.